This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. Grammatics is the use of grammar in schools to teach language and to improve literacy. And this idea may sound harmless and ideal on the surface, but it gave rise to grammar wars among educators in Malaysia and around the world. We have in the studio with us once again Dr. Derek Irwin, who's the head of School of English at the University of Nottingham Medical Malaysia campus. I'm so used to doing a health show. This is bad news. You're also a grammarian. Welcome to the show, Derek. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, Mira. Thank you.
Who's a grammarian? You're probably the first person I've actually met who is a grammarian.
Well, that's kind of a self-adopted title, I guess.
See, it doesn't exist, really?
No. A grammarian is one who studies grammar, basically. And there are various ways that one can be a grammarian or take the point of view of a grammatical approach to language. So I use grammar from a linguistic point of view. So a grammarian from that point of view is someone who is looking at language and describing the syntax and the morphology of language, which are the grammatical strata of language. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I wouldn't define myself as a strict grammarian at all. I use grammar in order to illuminate other aspects of language. So it's not in and of itself vital, but very useful in how it can be applied.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people enjoy it. I never enjoyed learning grammar in school. You know, I was just like, can we just go with what I know and what I'm used to saying, mm-hmm. As opposed to having to learn how to actually construct these sentences. And very often it has to do with errors and correctness, right?
That's right.
But you argue otherwise.
I do indeed. And in fact, the notion most linguists would take when looking at grammar is from a descriptive point of view. And what you're describing right now is what we would call a prescriptive point of view. So although I do have a doctorate which specializes in grammar, I don't generally write prescriptions for medicine or for grammar. And so I don't believe necessarily that grammar is there to tell people the right way to do things. A linguist will use the tools to analyze what is being done in language. So the idea of rules of language in some ways can be a fundamentally flawed one. Instead, we talk about regularities in language. It makes a little bit more sense when you look at it from that direction. Mm-hmm. So, grammar is a tool with which to describe this incredibly complex human capability we call language. And we did talk about this a little bit last time. It's a very, very phenomenally complex means of allowing these kind of complex objects we call brains to interact. And so brains themselves are the most complex items in the universe. Some, like Gerard Edelman, will argue that including the universe itself, mm-hmm. the brain is actually more complicated than anything else that we know of. And those brains interacting is incredibly complex as well. Yeah. So not only do you have all these neurons inside a brain, but you have billions of people using all of these at the same time and trying to interact with them. Linguistics as a science is the study of how we do that, so what we're doing in language. And grammar is one aspect of approaching linguistics as a holistic endeavor. So,
which you are. You are also, you specialize in systemic functional linguistics.
This particular approach to linguistics does fundamentally treat language as a holistic endeavor. So some forms of linguistics will say, no, all we're interested in is the sentence. So the sentence is kind of the upper region of what we'll look at. Mm-hmm. Other forms of language inquiry, like discourse analysis, want to look at much larger stretches of language. And there are various types of discourse analysis, various types of grammars as well, which is very complicated and confusing. Because as I said, there's not just descriptive and prescriptive grammar, but there's also formal and functional grammars. Mm-hmm. What is grammar? When I say grammar, you say the rules you were taught in
yes.
school.
Mm-hmm.
A grammarian might differ and say, no, it's the kind of underlying patterns of language. Other people might say, well, a grammar is a book on grammar. So that's another definition. So when we're mandating grammar in schools, this is why the term grammatics becomes important, because grammatics is the use of grammar in a pedagogical or school situation. So how do we do it, and which grammar do we use? And that's a very important question.
Who determines the rules and, you know, of grammar?
Oh, I'd like to pretend I do. But in fact, there's a very long tradition of who determines the rules. In the history of English, I mean, the descriptions of English, the reason why we have certain prescriptions as we do now is because it was being done by medieval monks and scholars. And so they were very familiar with Greek and Latin. And Greek and Latin were the kind of prototypes of perfection, right? So Latin especially, dead language, or classical Greek, Latin has these wonderful rules, and because no one is speaking it as a living language, you can freeze the language and say, this is how it's done, okay? So because no one is mucking about with it in a vernacular, although of course the Italians were speaking the descendant of it and mm-hmm. creating this terrible vernacular, you know, which had it's messy because you can't freeze it. You know, but Latin has rules that you can talk about. So then when you're describing English, you want to say how it's this kind of messy descendant and doesn't quite attain the perfection of these beautiful crystalline languages of the classics. And how do you then make English
accessible?
Well, not just accessible, but how do you make it perfect? Yeah. So you make it perfect by giving it rules. And so you tell people, well, you should do this. You know, splitting an infinitive is the famous example. You know, the beginning to Star Trek?
Yes.
Right? Where, you know, what were you doing? Well, our mission is to boldly go. That's terrible, right? You put boldly inside of to go, mm-hmm. which is an infinitive form. It's easy in English to do this. It's not a problem, right? And in fact, in English, it better describes sometimes the process within an infinitive to put an adverbial modifier inside of it. Sorry, this is all technical language. I apologize, especially to those listeners who may not want to be inundated with all these word categories.
But then I'm just thinking, right? It must really, really upset you, because everywhere people are breaking the rules.
In fact,
advertising,
it
you know.
It really excites me, because this is what the real fun of language is, right? Language is living. I'm not a classical Latin scholar, and I don't think that there's a perfect form of language. So I don't get worked up when people are using it flexibly. As my friends and colleagues will tell you, I am probably one of the most creative users of certain vernacular forms of the language. And, you know, I come by that honestly because of my upbringing, I think. But
could you give me an example?
I'm talking about profanity particularly, so I'm not going to give you an example on the air. We can talk about this later, perhaps.
But I should have known that.
I was being a little bit gentle with my description of that. But certainly, using language creatively, we wish to do this in creative writing, for example. Every generation does this, because when you see people texting, there's a very, very good reason that people don't type out words in full. Why? Well, you have a character limitation on how much that you can send. You have a time limitation, especially on the old phones where you have to press mm-hmm. three times to get
yes.
each letter. So we built up this marvelous, essentially shorthand version of the English language that people are using as a vernacular. And it has a grammar. It has structure. It has what we would call regularities, or if you wish, you can talk about them as rules. And this is a beautiful thing to study. So it's not necessarily something to get upset about. It's something to say, why is this being done? And particularly, in which contexts is it being done?
Mm-hmm. So it's quite flexible that way.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A good grammar can be used. Grammar is in the sense of the system we use to describe language, can be applied in many different situations and contexts. In the classroom, that's a very specific context. So because of the classroom being used to teach English as an academic endeavor, potentially, mm-hmm. or English as other endeavors, a knowledge of the types of grammars of written English then becomes important. But that is not to supersede the importance of English in other contexts. So texting is something people pick up and do naturally. And what we need to teach then in the classroom is how to change register. So register meaning the choice of language at any given time. Spoken and written language have very different grammars. This has been studied for quite some time. M.A.K. Halliday has written a book quite a while ago on the differences between spoken grammar and written grammar, and there are some very important differences. Written grammars are very dense, and they are, in fact, usually sentences in written grammars are fairly grammatically simple at the clause level. Okay, so how we combine a subject, verb, and object in a kind of traditional grammatical description. And the clause complexes, so how we combine those subject, verb, objects in logical fashion can be a little more complicated. Spoken grammars are very sparse in terms of lexical items. We don't have a lot in a spoken grammar that is experientially embedded. But we do have an awful lot of grammatical strings. So if you ever hear a kid talk, and then, da-da-da-da, and then, da-da-da-da, mm-hmm. and then, but, or, and then. And so this is one long clause complex, but it's being done in a much more diffuse fashion. So we need to teach different types of grammars for different types of contexts.
What about Manglish and Singlish and, you know, how with...
Oh, they're gorgeous.
I figured being the flexible person that you are, you know, it would be beautiful to you. But how has that affected us taking on the English language and Malaysianizing it to a very large extent?
It has been a huge boon and a partial detriment. A huge boon because any form of generally understood English is an overall benefit for the society if the goal is to have English. So any form of, we talked last time, I think, about the difference between a Creole and a jargon and these type of things. But a nativized version of English, the one that you're taught at a very young age and is used extensively in the society, is hugely beneficial to the general level of English. Features of that may or may not be internationally comprehensible. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's the question that may be underlying what you're asking is, so when features of it make it potentially non-intelligible to other English speakers, then there can be a slight communicative failure. When we're talking about written forms, though, so that's a spoken version. And really, what is our goal with spoken language of any sort? We want to understand each yep. other, right? And so if I'm shopping, I want to get my stuff and pay for it. If, you know, if I'm at a restaurant, I want to get my food and not have it in a form I don't enjoy, you know. So we use language very pragmatically in spoken language and sometimes just for the beauty of language, you know, sit around, tell stories, have fun. This is all great. Mm-hmm. No one really cares about your grammar at that point. You know, if I'm out on a fishing trip with my buddies in Canada and I've had more than one beer, I'll let you know that my grammar is not impeccable.
Is that all it takes?
Maybe slightly more than one. I don't want to insult my own abilities here. But the long and short is those are contexts in which you are only worried about the mutual intelligibility and the enjoyment. And so this is the underlying reason why a lot of schools, including those in Malaysia, have a fundamental goal of communicability. So they want to use English to communicate. Mm-hmm. And in fact, presently, from the papers that I've heard recently talking about the state of grammar teaching in Malaysia, the goal for grammar is only to be used as it supports the goal of communicability. So if you're teaching a lesson and you want to communicate with whatever situation you're providing, grammar is meant to be the
it takes a back
support.
Seat. Yeah.
Well, back seat, but yeah, it's you know, I'm in this situation, what mm-hmm. kind of grammar do I use? The problem with that is that in spoken language, we're not using the same strict forms of grammar. Mm-hmm. There may be certain aspects of the language we'll employ, but it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have a kind of strict regularity of that language. As I can well tell you, being a poor speaker of many languages, in a oral situation, poor language speaking is better than no language speaking. Yeah. And really all you care about is the pragmatics, right? So, you know, are you going to get that beer? Are you, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
What we're worried about in the academic setting, though, and what they become worried about in the business world, let's say, so the often heard complaint of many, many nations where English is taught as a second or foreign language, is that even graduates from a school in which English is taught do not have a sufficient level of English to be able to create proper communications or to be able to operate in it. Invariably, those are in written form. Okay, so that's the most common issue, is if someone is writing a memo and it's not intelligible or there are what we would call errors in the English, that's the problem. So we're dealing with different grammars. And so I think we have to recognize that. And we also, if I can continue my grammar rant and...
Go on, I'm listening. Right,
this is what I do. I get excited about grammar and I just can't stop.
I can see it in your eyes.
When we treat grammar as a series of rules, okay, what we're doing is basically teaching students piecemeal, very small slivers of the language, which they should correct. So we're saying, you're doing this wrong, fix it, this is how you fix it. That works poorly. And this is where the grammar wars that we kind of started the idea of this program came about, is people are studying the effectiveness of grammar in the classroom, and they're saying, I mean, opinions split. This is why it's called a war. Some people are saying you must teach grammar in the classroom. You cannot teach language without having grammar. And even in the first language classroom, because these wars are taking place or have taken place in Australia and Canada and the U.S. I mean, all sorts of places which teach grammar, then abandon grammar, then say we should teach it, then we say we don't want to teach it.
Is it a teach or not, or just prioritize?
It's a climb. Okay, so it's at one end are people who are saying do not teach it because it interferes with how to create language. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of first language countries, so in Canada, for example, we had very, very sporadic grammar teaching when I grew up. I graduated from my Bachelor of Arts, an honors bachelor's with a minor in English, and I went to teach ESL in Korea. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did immediately following my degree. And I was in class, and a six-year-old Korean child was correcting my grammar because I didn't know. I had never been taught in school the types of terms for what these children were learning from a very prescriptive, very formal background. So he was asking something about a fine point in grammar, and I couldn't answer him. Mm-hmm. And so I was so horrified, I decided to, you know, go get a doctorate in grammar. So, path of most resistance, perhaps.
And brings you right here to tell us more about it. We're discussing grammar with Dr. Derek Owen. If you have a question for him, send it through the number 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. It is The Bigger Picture. We're discussing grammar with Dr. Derek Owen. He's the head of School of English at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus. He's also a grammarian, and we're trying to find out a little bit more about grammar. There is a war going on. Some schools of thought believe that, you know, you shouldn't teach grammar in school. There are some who think you must teach grammar. But, you know, if it's all about the rules, Dr. Derek, instead of teaching these rules, if you don't teach them, then how else do you learn this?
My argument is that you should teach grammar as a system. So an understanding of how language fits together, again, using this word holism, so how the entire system of systems works together.
Mm-hmm. As you said earlier, as a series of rules. Is that it?
No, no, not as a series of rules, mm-hmm. in fact, but as a series of regularities. Because we know these aren't rules. They're the regularities of English are very different than the regularities of Mandarin, of Tamil, of Malay. So it's not that one type of regularity is correct or incorrect. There are ways, though, that we can be very, very ineffective in the ways we use language. And there are ways that we can actually be incorrect in basic fundamentals of the language, particularly in written forms. Okay, so the question is, if you're saying grammar should or shouldn't be taught in schools, which grammar are you speaking of?
Mm-hmm.
So am I saying we should or shouldn't teach these rules of grammar? Because the argument with the grammar wars generally comes down to the ideas of what we might call a word grammar, or at best, a phrase-level grammar. So this is teaching you things like tree is a noun, and you know, jump is a verb.
Verb, yeah.
And these are useful if you're looking things up in the dictionary. They're not as useful if you're interested in how to put the language together in increasingly complicated or complex ways. We talked about this a little bit in the kind of warm-up to the show, where we were saying if you're teaching kids about grammar, you can start from the bottom up. You can say, okay, this is how letters fit together. And we do this, right? A is for apple, B is for ball. And these fit together in this way. And then these words fit together in the following way. And this is how we make sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking at language from the bottom up, it's quite bewildering in a way, because there's a massive choice, right? So there are so many words, there are so many potential combinations, there are so many ways to get it wrong. If you're looking at language from the top down, so you take language as a system of ways to make text. So for kids, the best way of doing this is probably in stories. Here is a story. Okay, this is the story of X. And you can translate a written text very easily into spoken text by picking apart the lexical items and making them more diffuse, right? So, you know, what does Mary's ball mean? Well, Mary's ball means a ball that belongs to Mary,
mm-hmm.
right? This, and then it compacts into Mary's ball. Mary's ball is red. How do we then compact that further? We can say Mary's red ball. And so this is how the diffusion of spoken language then gets put into written language. So that's a first step. But the other step is to say, here is a whole text, and that this is a way to tell a story. Okay, so what are the features of this that makes it a story? Does it make it an effective story? Why or why not?
So you dissect the finished product.
In a way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do this down in ways that kids easily understand, right? I explain grammar to my own kids, and, you know, they're big readers, and they understand, in a way, what I'm talking about. Not all the technical terms. I mean, grammar itself you could call a meta-language, okay? So this is language about language.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked about language being one of the most complex system of systems that you can imagine, because it's the product of the human brain. So the language about language is similarly complex. And so this it becomes very baffling. It's great when you announce you're a grammarian, because immediately everyone stops in horror, right? And they don't want to talk to you.
Which I did.
That's everyone's initial reaction. That's why no one claims to be a grammarian, right? Because why would I want to be one? But what's useful, of course, is, you know, striking people with horror can sometimes be quite fun. And when you talk about how language works, it's a very complex kind of area. And that's what makes it fun. Right, is because it's enormously difficult to learn about. It can be difficult to talk about, but there's no reason why you can't simplify that meta language. And it depends on your perspective of what the appropriate meta language is. If I'm talking about word categories, then you're going to have 8 or 9 no matter what. So you've got your noun, adjective, adverb, verbs, interjections, all of these type of things, right? Conjunctions. And You're already falling asleep.
No,
I
I'm not.
Tell.
I'm listening. It just took me back to English class in school, and I'm thinking, there he goes. No, I got confused with the proposition and the pronouns and the, you know, whatever else that came after the 9.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the pronoun is
I'm like, I don't need to know this.
You do need to know this, but you don't necessarily need to know that meta language. right? So you need to know the fact that he can replace a nominal group which has a male orientation, because you'll do it all the time, right? Because in spoken language, you don't want to keep using a personal name. So you don't say John, 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 because that becomes wearing on the ear. And it's, we have short forms in language. So then you would just use the pronoun to replace that, he, right? Mm-hmm. And that's very simple. But as soon as you start getting that meta language jumping in on top, then it's a huge leap, right? So with kids, when you're teaching them this type of thing, it's actually quite a bit easier sometimes to come in through function. So we were talking about the difference very briefly between functional and formal approaches. Formal doesn't mean, you know, it's wearing a bow tie and going out to dinner. It means you're looking at the form, you're looking at the properties of it. So functional doesn't mean it's just usable. It means that you're looking at the uses of. And so if we're looking at language in use, then we can use whatever terms we think are appropriate. And we can talk about types of verbs. We can talk about participants, right? Because this type of language isn't very difficult. Mm-hmm. The very basic way that we approach this in our writing guide, so we've written a writing guide called So Where's Your Thesis? And this was published last year. I had to write the chapter on mechanics, right? And mechanics is the big bugbear of any writing guide, because that's where you have to get in all the rules and you have to tell people, what's a comma splice? Don't write a comma splice because, you know, your teacher will mark it wrong and take away marks. So how do you get students to understand what a comma splice is? Because in order to understand this technical term, you have to understand what a clause is, you have to understand clause combination, you have to understand basic punctuation, and you have to understand the other ways that you can avoid it by combining clauses. So this will involve things like conjunctions, conjunctive adjuncts, and again, this is all jargon. It's being thrown at you, right? So the way that we decided to approach it in this particular book is simply to approach it through experiential terms. What is a clause? I mean, this is the first piece of jargon I've been throwing around. And what is a clause? Well, a clause is a set of units in which we complete a proposition with knowing who does what, to whom, under what circumstances. And that's all. I mean, that's what a clause is. And we combine clauses and we do fancy things with them. But at a very basic level, all you need in a clause is doing what. And if we are getting really fancy, we can have who is doing what. And if we get super fancy, we got who is doing what to whom. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a little spicy addition to that is under what circumstances. So you can say when it happens or where it happens or all. Now, this is not difficult to understand. This is basic grammatical parsing. This is just knowing the participants, the processes. But once you have that as a kind of basic level, and you can say, okay, I'm going to build a clause that has this process, has these participants, this is the type of way I'm going to make them interact, then you understand what would make something like a sentence fragment. A sentence fragment is a clause without the proper parts of that proposition. Mm-hmm. So if you have a doing what without a who, you probably have a sentence fragment. Certain types of verbs, you also need to have the to whom, or else you have a sentence fragment. Some verbs, you need a circumstance as well. So the verb put, you can't just say she put. You need to say she put something somewhere, right? And then you'll have a complete proposition. So, but this is not difficult if you're approaching it from that perspective. It gets very difficult, though, if you try to approach it from the other perspective and say things like, well, the verb to put is a complex transitive verb, and it's a complex transitive verb because you need to have a subjective and objective position.
See, now you really sound like my English teacher in school.
And this is the problem.
Yeah.
Because that is what makes it completely incomprehensible. Yes. And as soon as it's incomprehensible, people are like, grammar, I don't want to learn that. It's crazy. Yeah. But it isn't that difficult if you're explaining it in ways that are accessible.
Mm-hmm. Based on the students that you teach at school, Derek, what are some of the challenges that Malaysian students face? I'll come back just after the market update on BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. It is The Bigger Picture. We're discussing grammar with Dr. Derek Irwin. He's head of School of English at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus. Grammar is not something that most of us, I think, enjoyed in school. But, you know, Derek, based on the Malaysian students that you have actually taught, what are some of the mistakes that, common mistakes that we seem to make?
Okay, well, again, the idea of mistake is relative, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the grammar guides that I've been involved in writing, and we do have one that's in press right now for writers. This is, first of all, descriptive in nature, so saying how you build up the grammatical systems and how you understand them in terms of rhetoric. And then we move into the ideas of prescriptivism, so how, if you're getting papers back with the following things circled, this is how you make the change. The system here, I think, needs a change in the sense of being able to talk about the differences between the spoken and the written form. So, I was going to ask you,
how do you make that distinction? Because even I make that mistake. I tend to translate exactly how I speak to paper, and as you said, grammar, spoken grammar, and written grammar is entirely different.
Well, what you do is you hire me.
That was a plug, wasn't it? An open invitation for a plug.
Yeah, exactly. I do these lectures to thousands. No, understanding the difference between spoken and written grammar has to do with a whole revamping of the system where we train teachers. It is not exclusive to Malaysia. There's no reason to think that this area is any better or worse than a lot of other areas. In fact, I come out of a system where, you know, ostensibly English is a first language, and yet the first year students were writing so poorly in the Canadian context that we felt compelled to write these books to try to help them. It's not that they were necessarily writing enormously poorly on any given level, but that they didn't understand the discourse systems and they hadn't been properly taught how to translate their inner speaking voice into a written voice. And this, again, comes back to that idea that I talked about briefly with register. So even in written language, there is absolutely no problem with having a more informal spoken tone in certain forms of writing. So children's books, as we spoke about before, will have a more written as if spoken aspect, mm-hmm. because they are designed largely to be spoken aloud.
Read aloud,
right?
Yeah.
So this is what we do with them. So there are features of children's books which are specifically spoken-like. However, what we're trying to do with students is move them into the most formal, complex, difficult register of language in English. And this is the academic register of English. And for them to be able to produce things in this, first of all, it's very, very helpful for them to understand that it is a register. That what they're doing is they're making a transition between a certain type of text creation into a different one. And so in doing that, they will have to know the types of patterns which are valuable in that register. Okay, and these patterns are different in that register than they are in things like texting. So, you know, when you're writing your professor, you probably don't want to use text speak in your email. I think it's funny, but other people will get very offended, right?
Yep.
You know, how dare you write me something without a subject line? Interestingly, why historically, this is because we see email as a written mode. So it is mail, which is electronic,
yes.
And students see it as a spoken mode.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very fast means of communication to get something to someone and get hopefully an instantaneous response.
Right.
Two different registers going on with the same modality, mm-hmm. right? The same type of text. It leads to problems. So if people understand that what they're doing is they're creating text for context, then they have to learn how to do that in these contexts. That's where people like me actually do come in handy, because we can step in and we can say, well, these are the types of patterns which you will find in this. In a novel, you have other people who are very good at that. The creative writing instructors are fantastic in saying, this is how you create a text in for this particular context, right? Poetry has a certain type of context. But for academic English, it's a different set of skills.
Joe was asking, nowadays in the newspapers and everywhere else, he doesn't quite see the word whom being used. Is there a reason for that?
Because whom is difficult.
What do you mean by difficult?
Okay, so I can give you a very good reason why you should drop whom. Whom is a remnant of having a... in simplified terms, subject and object position. So you having a case marker between the subject and the object. So who is subject position, mm-hmm. whom is object position. We still have this in the pronouns, right? So we still have he kissed her, not her kissed he, right? Because you can't switch the subject and object position with pronouns. But if we said, you know, the boy kissed the monkey, it's no problem to say the monkey kissed the boy.
Yes.
We don't have to inflect for case unless you were to say, whom did the boy kiss? Because then we know, oh, it's the boy doing the kissing, not the monkey.
Right.
Or whoever the boy was kissing. So this is why whom still is part of this. But in spoken English, no one will say that. In spoken English, everyone, I think, except... you know, pedantic people like me would say, "Who did the monkey kiss?" Or "Who did the monkey kiss?" Right.
Yes.
So you know, this is—it's grammatically correct if you are going to insist on the difference between subject and objective case, due to wherever these things are found in the clause. Is it crucial? No. There are lots of places in the language that if you study the usage of it in descriptive terms, you can easily predict that this is just going to eventually be gone. English has been moving to non-case inflectedness. Old English was inflected for case for all the nouns. Mm-hmm. So it was much freer in word order. You could take your object and put it at the beginning of the sentence. Everyone still knew it was the object because it was inflected morphologically. So it had an ending that indicated that it was still the object. And the subject could be anywhere as well because you knew it was the subject because of its inflectional. But in contemporary English, subject position is usually here's the verb, look to the left. Object is usually here's the verb, look to the right. So we'll lose the whole case distinction as we go on. I don't know if the pronouns will change anytime soon, but long after we're gone. I predict you can save this podcast and go back to it and say, yeah, that Derek, he predicted the loss of case.
So, I mean, if grammatics is so flexible, you know, as you've made it sound.
Grammatics is not flexible, but grammatics is the use of grammar to study the language in the classroom. Grammar is flexible.
Okay, so if grammar is so flexible, then where do you see all of these going? Where do you draw the line to keep or maintain some of the traditional grammar? Or are we just going to lose all of it?
We will gain as much as we lose, because language will develop the capacity to communicate what's needed to be communicated, whether it's lexically, so picking up new things in words, or grammatically, if there are new types of relationships that we're going to need to express, we will do that. Humans are amazing languaging monkeys. I mean, it's a phenomenal capacity of ours, right? So we do this, and we are going to keep doing this. The people who generally want to stop grammar from changing are those who say, you know, this is the height of attainment of language. And so, you know, we must maintain the number distinction and the gender distinction in our pronouns. And if we don't do that, then we're all going to be called yo. What's wrong with everyone being called yo? That would be fantastic, right?
Your final message on grammar, Dr. Derek.
My final message is that grammar should be seen as a way to help explain language as it's used and as we expect students to use it in their studies and the text we want them to create. There are very good ways to go about looking at grammar as a system that we can impart upon teachers and then students so that they can better create effective text. But to tell students that this is right and this is wrong, and that is where we start to blur the line. And we begin to present grammar as this piecemeal system that baffles people and alienates them. So instead of doing that, I think people should see the beauty of grammar. Grammar is an explanatory tool, and as such, it gives us insights into the ways that we make meaning. That, I think, is an enormously powerful thing and something that we should celebrate. And the more people who understand it, the more fun it'll be, because then we can all talk about it.
Thank you very much for joining me today. Dr. Derek Owen, Head of School of English, University Nottingham, Malaysia Campus, also a grammarian, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.